You are listening to Viva and Barnes, Law for the People. I am Viva Fry, David Fryheit, a Montreal litigator turned YouTuber. Robert Barnes is a world-renowned American civil rights attorney. In each podcast, we are going to break down and explain things that are going on in the legal world around us in terms that can be understood by everyone. The audio is pulled directly from our weekly live streams on YouTube, where you can find us on my channel, Viva Fry. And although the audio is not perfect when it comes to knowledge, knowledge is more important than audio quality. Enjoy your podcast. Good evening, people. Good evening, everyone. In case anybody doesn't know, it is my birthday today. Today, 42 years old. I think I was born on a Tuesday. And I was born in the morning, but this is close enough. It's actually May 23rd, 42 years old, and second birthday under the COVID restrictions, which I never in a million years thought would have ever happened. I remember last year, I had a bet with Nate Brody that we would be having drinks at my parents' cottage on the lake on a dock, if not by my birthday, at the very least by summer. How wrong I was and how right Nate Brody was. People, this is going to be amazing. First of all, I don't want anyone feeling bad and saying like, oh, Viva, take a day off. It may sound crazy. It may sound like I'm neglecting my family duties. But I could not think of another way of spending my birthday. There's two things. I don't really care much about birthdays in general. I like getting gifts, but I don't like birthdays as the excuse for gifts, but I don't say no. So I don't think much of birthdays in general. I just want to do the thing that makes me the happiest in general. Typically, when the world was a normal, sane, free place, it involved a round of golf, a barbecue with my parents, and a martini. I could probably do those things now, but I even if I could play golf, I wouldn't play golf because I'd rather be, you know, at home with the kids. 5 hours on a golf course is nice, but I would feel bad for, you know, not being at home with the kids. And I'd rather be at home playing or fishing with the kids. What I've turned into from what I was as a troubled youth. The barbecue I could probably do with my parents, but they're in a cottage. I'm back in Montreal, and I had the barbecue last night with some wicked, wicked steak, which I love. And tonight, not a martini, but I'm having a little something. For anybody who can see that real quick, I don't even want to say the name of it because it has words in it that might entice certain algorithmic bots that go out detecting words, irregardless, which is not a word, regardless of context. So let's see what we're going to do. Tonight, it's going to be a good one. There's a lot of stuff. There's nothing groundbreaking, momentous like back in the day. You know, no new real developments in Chauvin, although there are some. But there's just, you know, the law keeps working its way into politics. Politics keeps working its way into law. And what a world it is with some of the stories. Before we get into the stories and what's on the menu, and because I've seen a few super chats come in and I want to get to them. A birthday toast for you, Rain Silversplash. It's a good name. Thank you very much. Before I even lose track, super chats. YouTube gets 30% of the super chats. So if that bothers any of you and you want to support us another way, you're going to hear Barnes say it at least five times. Viva, barneslaw.locals.com. $5 a month, the same membership fee that you get on YouTube. The percentage is better for the creator, which might make people feel better. The entity is better for the supporter, which people might like. And they are really rolling out some big stuff. They're going to be rolling out live streams. They're going to be rolling out super chat type functions. But it's a good community. And all the content is still going to be on YouTube and Rumble. Second thing. Sorry, I'm also on Rumble. We are streaming live on Rumble simultaneously. Someone let me know if it's not working. So if that bothers you, you can support other ways if you so choose, and you don't need to support. The greatest support is just sharing the channel, sharing the videos with people who don't know that we exist. I'm going to miss some super chats. So if that's going to miff you, don't give the super chat. I don't like people feeling miffed. I would actually rather have people not donate and not feel miffed than having people donate and feeling miffed. That's it. No legal advice. We'll see when Robert gets here. I might get into a rant before Robert gets here because Hey, plus ça change, plus ça reste le même. More things change, the more they stay the same. And we are now in month five. You know, the province is starting to open up in a way that's going to create classes of citizens, in that certain freedoms are going to apply to certain people who have been vaccinated and not to others who haven't. Which brings me into a tweet that I had on the Twitterverse. Two things. I know I say do not feed the trolls, and it's a good rule because you'll know when you're dealing with a troll, an intellectual troll, not necessarily like an abusive troll, but an intellectual troll, when you're dealing with a perpetually moving target. And you know this right away. You learn this, or you get the impression of this within one or two exchanges, where when it is a moving target, you can quickly assess that you're not having a discussion with someone who wants to arrive at the truth, but rather wants to find a method of attack. That's what I call an intellectual troll. Now, typically, engaging with this is only going to be a source of frustration because the targets keep moving. So the original accusation, once successfully defended against, moves and pivots into another accusation, which when successfully defended against, pivots into another accusation. And it's just, you're chasing an ever-moving target. But sometimes engaging or responding is not useful for the exchange with the individual, but for informing the general public. And sorry, I got that super chicker up here. Oh yeah, we're going to get to this one tonight, Life of Brian. So Ethan Klein tweets out, being vaccinated is F-U-C-K-I-N-G-ing awesome, or F-ing great, whatever, it's something like that. And the first thing is, I want to know if he gets paid for these tweets, because we now know officially that influencers are getting paid to promote medical messages. And so digest that how you will, even if you are the most pro-vaccination person in the world. Imagine that we're in a world where, the Joe Rogans get in trouble for offering their opinion because they're not doctors, but other influencers get paid to promote medical advice, effectively, nothing short of that. They get paid to do it, and they're not doctors. They're paid influencers pushing a message, whatever. So Ethan Klein puts that out. I then said, this is in a separate tweet that I retweeted, I said, this is vaccine supremacy at work. To which someone says, how is this supremacy? And I said, we're literally creating a tier system in society of rights that are going to apply to certain people, but not to others. That is effectively the definition of some form of supremacy, and you can fill in the blank to see how it's manifested itself historically. And then the person responds with another moving target. You know, oranges are great is not orange supremacy. It doesn't mean apples are awful. And I just tweeted a response of what our prime minister effectively said in the province. We're going to start opening things up. You can do certain things if you're fully vaccinated. And for everyone who thinks that this is just merely a question of being an anti-vaxxer, defiant, oppositional, whatever, there are people who are not going to be able to get vaccinated for health reasons. And I can tell you, I know a few who, for health reasons, cannot get vaccinated. Anybody who knows, there are certain conditions that you can get in life that means that you can't get vaccinated afterwards. And so it's not just a question of stubborn political hatred if you want to demonize them that way. There's realities to vaccination where you're creating a two-tiered system where people through no fault of their own are now going to have minimized rights because it's awesome. And we should have special rights for some, or just general rights for some, but not for others. Not to mention, we know certain demographics do not want to get vaccinated at a higher rate or are not getting vaccinated for whatever the reason. And so it's not any form of exaggeration to identify the problem before it materializes itself, is that you're, by creating second-class citizens, you may think you're justified in doing it, but you're creating second-class citizens. So that was my rant. And so I've had this, I try to treat everyone like they are asking legitimate questions and that they're engaged in legitimate discourse, even if they disagree with me and even if they call me names. But when I determine that it's not intellectually honest discourse, it is trolling for the sake of trolling, moving target, find a reason, try to find a slip up so you can continue the attack, then I have to disengage because I want to preserve my own mental well-being. Now, with that said, let's get to some super chats and then we're going to get to the menu of the day. Washington State is the only, oh, sorry, liberty or death, revaccine supremacy. Washington State is only allowing employers to drop mask mandates if employees prove vaccination. If not, still have to wear a mask. We're going to discuss it tonight because it's going to come up without a doubt. And I see Robert's there, so I'm going to get to these super chats, get to the menu, and then we're going to move on. Happy birthday. Texas was free this weekend. My wife and I went out to eat, fishing and golfing without a mask. Mask mandate was lifted by Governor Abbott. So much fun seeing friends and pretending we didn't recognize each other. Freedom is socializing with friends. I'm going to get to this in a second. Thank you very much, Beavis. Yoshi Rabbit Preacher says, happy birthday. It is my birthday too. What a great day to be born. Having whiskey to celebrate. Enjoy it. Happy birthday to you as well. We got Long Reach Jones. I don't know what that means, but it sounds interesting. 14 months after start of pandemic, having reduced infections to near zero for 6 months, Australia government started issuing fines for no mask on public transport. Hey, government does not soon give back rights that they usurp, and they don't give them back without getting something in return. Please do a sidebar with the great Canadian Steve Smith, Red Green. We can do that. And I have a lot of people on the menu. We have some great sidebars coming up, and we've got a lot of stuff on the menu. So everyone who has made recommendations, I'm doing my best. I've got people that we have to connect with and schedule dates, but that's it. Okay, on the menu tonight, let me just go to my notes because I've taken notes. And by notes, I mean screenshots. On the menu, and it's a good one. Epstein, we're going to talk about some eternal truths. Election audit updates in a few more states now. Biden has been having some rough days in courts on some of the lawsuits that are being filed under his administration, in particular on the racial restrictions on certain relief being sought from farmers to restaurants. Vaccination for children. There's a fascinating lawsuit that's been filed by the AFLD, American Frontline Doctors. And we're only going to be discussing lawsuits, and we're only going to be discussing audits and lawsuits. We're not expressing opinions, and certainly not questioning the unquestionable. Counseling. Oh, another law that restricts freedom of speech about counseling and what counselors are allowed to discuss with their patients. It's a very interesting lawsuit. The lawyer's decision in strategy in representing the people arrested on the January 6th riots. Some interesting decisions were made, and I think they're going to be regretted. Chauvin trauma misconduct allegations, Rittenhouse update, Christian College lawsuit, and Trump witch hunt in New York, going to be an interesting discussion. And then, you know, the Canadian stuff updates, which if I didn't get to already, I'll get to in a second. I see Robert. He is looking dapper and stern. Robert, how you doing?
Good, good.
All right. Someone just won a bet out there. I know it. Yes, we have our standard intros, everyone. And if it doesn't go that way, I start to get nervous. Hold on. Did I just see it right here? Hold on. I think I saw a super chat that might have mentioned. Oh, okay. I missed it. Whatever. Okay. Robert, what do we start with tonight? First of all, where are you? You're at home in Vegas now?
Yes. Yes. Start off with happy birthday. And for everybody out there, what's the best way to give a gift? Give the gift that gives back to you. Join vivabarneslaw.locals.com. Do it for Viva's birthday.
Robert is you are a generator of interest and traffic to Locals. It's phenomenal. And it is good because, Robert, you are showing through our channel or through our page what Locals can be used for, how it should be used, and how it can really... It can generate support. It can allow people to support. And the exclusive content you get, not as in a perk. It's just you've created a community, and it's a place for people to get information, news, discourse. It's what social media should be, because it's actually social and it's actually still media. Let's see here. I know I saw something, Robert. The answer 42 is the meaning of life, which Eric Hundley put out a nice montage, which I shared on Twitter. It's hilarious. Okay, let's do this. Happy birthday. You are not allowed to ask about the meaning of life for the next year. This is true. And nor will I be able to ask for next year. Okay, Robert, what do we start with? I think it's a trilogy, right? With the Biden lawsuits that were filed. And I think maybe it's going to be the best series to start with, because one's going to lead into the other. And there's a few of them. So look, for those of you who don't know, do we call it the Biden administration or just the government in its ARPA giving COVID relief to restaurant owners had basically said, we're going to give $29 billion in relief to restaurant owners and restaurateurs who have been suffering under COVID. This is the policy that they were enacting under. I'm going to forget the acronyms, but you'll get it when you clarify my mistakes. They basically say we're going to give $30 billion to restaurant owners for the losses that they have sustained due to the government regulations shutting them down, et cetera, et cetera. With a but, they say we're going to prioritize not disenfranchised groups, but marginalized groups or the most disaffected groups, I guess, for lack of a better word. And they say we're going to prioritize restaurant owners that are women and restaurant owners that are, I say marginalized groups, but it basically comes down to minorities, ethnic visible minorities, which under the evidence that the government produced to justify the policy effectively comes down to saying white people have had historical advantages for getting loans from banks, et cetera, that it basically means it's going to be everyone except for white people who are going to white males effectively, because females are prioritized under this as well. They're going to get not extra benefits, just advanced access to the benefits. So for the first 21 days, marginalized groups and women can apply for the grants. What ended up happening within 9 days, they basically promised or gave away $9 billion of the 28. And they basically said, look, it's all gone. Like, it's all basically going to be guaranteed to the groups who apply in advance, who are marginalized groups and women, et cetera. Someone filed suit and said this is pure discrimination, because even before this $30 billion, which is supposed to be divided among the businesses who have been affected, before it can even get there, it's all guaranteed earmarked away to groups that discriminate for no logical basis. I didn't read the underlying lawsuit, but I mean, that's I think, good enough.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, basically, okay. This was the America First organization founded by Stephen Miller that brought suit first on behalf of farmers, then brought suit for restaurant owners and bar owners. Only difference being that for the farmers, it was no white people need apply, period. Whereas for restaurant owners and bar owners, it was no white men need apply. And it was a great win. The court said this is obvious discrimination. It doesn't meet the compelling interest standard. You didn't even go through and meet the metrics for that. You didn't show how that was necessary, because they likely could not, and said and enjoined it. And so it was a very big win right out of the gate against the Biden administration's own application of critical race theory and government application, which was going to determine whether or not you could get relief for COVID, particularly lockdown related reliefs that are mostly passed by Democratic governors based on the color of your skin or your gender. And the court said that clearly is unconstitutional. And that's what we predicted would happen, by the way.
Well, and it's I mean, look, it's I say encouraging, but it's not. The problem with these debates is that they immediately become racialized, because if you say it's a good decision, you sound like, and we're both white men, you're going to sound like white men who are angry that the government is trying to rectify historical wrongs to the extent that you adhere to that belief in the first place. Following the evidence, what's interesting in this case is that they went through the evidence that Congress or whichever the government officials, you know, used as a support for the policy. And it basically said, you know, historical prejudices, historical wrongs, historical discrimination, the inability to procure loans, a number of things which I think most people would probably agree with. But the judge said, good, even if we accept this, these are not specific to the restaurant industry. So these, if they apply to society at whole, they don't apply necessarily in the context of relief that is designed to target restaurateurs. And so, I mean, I guess the idea is, it's a compelling position, is if you want to do what is effectively, what's the word for writing, reparations. If you want to do reparations, do it distinctly by law and let people know that that's what it is, but don't do reparations, basically disguised reparations through COVID policy, because that's effectively what this was. And the judge said, if all of this is true, none of it applies specifically to restaurateurs, and therefore there's no rational connection between the discrimination and the policy.
Exactly. And my view is they would have established that factual record if they had it. And my view is they know they don't. They just wanted to, you know, discriminate in favor of certain groups based on race and gender. And that's what the Constitution does not allow, outside of exceptional circumstances that simply are not present here.
Does this, because this was filed by the same guy, the same individual who filed the farmers lawsuit, right?
Or the same group. So different plaintiffs, but the same group.
And now, does this is in Texas as well. So does this give an indication as to where the Texas farmer suit is going to go? How does it impact that?
Yes, it almost guaranteed the farmer suit they will win as well. So it'll be two big wins right out of the gate for the America First Legal Foundation, established by Stephen Miller, and very good restrictions right away on the Biden administration's attempt to racialize distribution of government resources.
And now, any lasting impacts on the government, or do they just try to do this again, but in, I don't know, another jurisdiction where another judge might take to it more favorably?
It'll be tough for them to do that. These are federal policies, so they can keep suing in Texas. So I think that, you know, they can try to get it reversed on appeal, and they may. I think that would be risky for them because now they're set up to lose across the board in ways that make very clear they can't do it. So we'll see. But I think that I don't see how the judge's ruling can be overturned, not in a way that's consistent with our case law or our Constitution. So it's always possible these days, but I think it's improbable.
And now, actually, maybe clarify this as well, because it's a distinction that exists under Canadian law, but maybe some people who are watching don't fully appreciate it. The latitude of a court of appeal in overturning a decision of the lower courts when it comes to matters of fact, matters of appreciation of evidence, and matters of law, there's a different threshold, and maybe it would be good to clarify for anybody who may not appreciate that.
For these purposes, it would be de novo review because he granted the temporary. Now, I mean, the injunction a little bit different, but because this was basically done on the law primarily. There wasn't an evidentiary hearing, to my knowledge. There wasn't a trial or anything like that. So they defer to judges on factual findings, but not legal conclusions. And so these were all legal conclusions. So they don't have to defer to them. But it's just once a court has established it and the logic is pretty impeccable, it's difficult to overturn without opening up Pandora's box that they can just say, well, in the past, there have been bad things happen to this group. So we're just going to distribute resources solely to this group. And again, this was supposed to be COVID relief. This wasn't supposed to be reparations bill. And so the trying to do this through COVID relief was itself problematic. There are additional problems. They didn't define what percentage certain socially disadvantaged groups is how they defined them. It does 20% black matter, 40%, 5%, you know, and it particularly, you know, it's the current identitarian politics doesn't quite fit into this legally, because what if people just identify in certain ways? For example, these days I identify as vaccinated. So, who knows how that works?
It is just amazing to see how in your face it is in terms of policy. It's good to see some courts standing up to it, but it is in your face, divisive. And I do not believe anybody who even believes in the legitimacy of these types of laws. I don't believe that any discrimination is really justified unless it is necessary by the essence or nature of the institution. But even the people who believe in it cannot deny or cannot be unaware of the fact this is going to create further racial divide and further discord among society. You have everybody who's suffering. Everybody. And someone's going to say, well, you're suffering less because of the historical benefits that I presume your family has gotten, not knowing if you're first generation white versus, you know, or if you're Irish or whatever it is. It's just going to create discord. And I do wonder if the cynical part of me wonders if it's not to some extent by design, or they just don't care. Like they think that it's just they're going to get enough of the majority at some point that they don't care if they're basically dividing and conquering.
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's sort of political extension. You know, it's protecting their own political voter groups over others. I mean, I think that's a lot of what was going on, and as well as disguised reparations. But they wanted the green light to discriminate however they wanted, and the court struck it down, which is the correct decision. And that might transition into the next big Biden loss, which was on the taxes, because the other thing he was trying to do was use COVID relief to prohibit states from cutting their own citizens' taxes. And that, too, the court said was clearly unconstitutional, was an attempt to commandeer the state for purposes that the 10th Amendment does not permit or allow. And so that was another excellent decision and another limitation. The Biden administration's effort so far to circumvent the Constitution and issues of immigration, lockdowns, taxes, state policy, and racial policy so far are mostly losing in courts, which is a good early indicator that courts are actually going to enforce the law and not allow them to get away with what they're trying to do, which is rewrite the Constitution without an amendment.
And now, is this the case that we discussed last week, which was commandeering, but requiring a state? It was, I think it was Texas, Mississippi, Alabama, basically saying if you're going to get the federal funding for COVID relief, you cannot issue any sort of state reduction in taxes. That was what we discussed last week, right?
Exactly. So we predicted that these cases would win, and they both won within a week.
Okay, because I know I feel like I'm going totally senile because I know we discussed it, and I don't think I did. I don't think I did a video on the lawsuit itself. Certainly not on the judgment. So I mean, what was the essence of the judgment? Pretty much straightforward application of well-known existing law.
Yep, same deal. It was, you know, the judge stepped in very quickly. Could have waited. Stepped in very quickly and struck it down. Said, no, you can't do this. You've known you can't do this. Don't try it. So it was major judicial restraints from a body that people were nervous would not really try to restrain this administration in the way they restrained the prior administration. But at least early decisions are good. Also, that may have also been in Texas as well.
I think it was. It's interesting. It's almost like in a cynical way, the government just says, let me see what I can get away with, and then I'll pull back. Or it's a win-win to some extent, or it's a no-lose situation. See what you can get away with. If it gets struck down, nice try. You don't have to pay for anything. It's all on taxpayer dollars anyhow. And see and test the limits of the courts. So and that's an interesting thing. So federal cases, because all of these are federal policy, the plaintiffs can pick pretty much any state they want. It's not as though any federal policy would have a specific state jurisdiction for some reason.
Yeah, and I hear Democrats' anti-Trump legislation or litigation is going to come back to bite them because they established a lot of these precedents. They went venue shopping aggressively and abusively, and they established the precedents that now can be used against them, and that's what's happening. The third example of this, though it wasn't a full win, the indicators are it's going in that direction, was the CDC case we discussed, the state of Florida against CDC. And the judge, rather than issuing a ruling, ordered that they go and mediate, which was a signal to the CDC that she's going to rule against them, but is giving them a way out by settling the case before she has to issue a ruling against them. But it shows it's another major Biden loss where he was trying to use the CDC to expand his authority into a wide range of spaces and places that it did not constitutionally or statutorily belong. And it was another pushback, even from a judge that was seen as likely sympathetic to the Biden administration. So it was another major setback for the Biden administration, and another major achievement for those of us who saw these as unconstitutional or illicit actions being attempted by the power grab being attempted by the Biden administration. It was a great week for the people that filed suit against the Biden administration.
Now, so I mean, how does this work? Because in terms of mediation or recommended mediation, so I presume, look, there was no contract. So it's not that there's contractual mediation, but the judge can say, look, try to settle this, sit down, and if it doesn't go anywhere, then you come back to court. Did the judge order it? Can the judge order it, or can they just recommend it? The parties go through the motions to try to see what happens. Nothing happens. They go back to court. Is that more like what's going on?
Yeah, well, they order mediation. They can order mediation in federal court. And generally, under these circumstances, when the judge said that they're going to issue an order and instead orders mediation, and you know which way the judge was leaning, then it's a strong indicator to the CDC to settle. If I was in the CDC's position, I know what that means. And I know, okay, they're letting me out without a written ruling against me, so I better take it. Now, if the CDC is dumb, then they'll go back and they'll get whacked. But that's how, given the judge's comments, given the judge's general proclivities, given the timing of the order, given the nature of those kind of orders in general, it's a strong indicator of where the judge wants things to go.
And we got Sean L. in Newfoundland, who's a half an hour ahead of us because we know what Newfoundland's time zone is like. And so, I mean, so basically the judge says, you know, go discuss. They're going to the CDC entities, defendant entities, are going to have no real, say, call it judicial or any risk interest to get back to court. They're going to talk with the industry and say, "What? Let's come to some compromise solution, something feasible, something plausible, something realistic," and then it disappears.
Yeah, I mean, the CDC just may walk away entirely. They may say, "Okay, as of June 1st, this expires," something like that.
Interesting. And then they would just apply what the standard protocol that's in effect for the state as a whole.
Correct. And basically it would remove the CDC from regulating the industry is what it, that's where I think it's going. That's the nature of that's the only place they can settle.
Okay, that's interesting. I mean, and then from a hand washing perspective, the CDC can say, it's up to you. We're going to withdraw it. If anything happens, the government can deal with it later. The cruise lines can deal with it later. We did our best and, you know, we walked away. So everybody can walk away a victor, and everyone can walk away responsibility free if it goes south down the line. And if it doesn't go south down the line, everybody can walk away the victor as well. Very interesting.
Yep. I mean, yeah, and this transitions into our next case. One response of the cruise industry is some of the cruise companies are requiring vaccinations even for children, or at least certain age groups, those teenagers, 12 to 15 years old, following the CDC saying they were going to authorize use of this vaccine for that age group because it hadn't been approved out of the gate. And that has led to two different legal actions. Bobby Kennedy has filed a citizen's petition with the FDA challenging that authorization. For the children's defense. I think it's children's health defense. I always get that confused.
Yeah, let me look it up. I took a screenshot just as I get it wrong as well. Tabarnouche, where is it? You know what? Forget it. I can't find it fast enough. I think children's defense.
And yeah, I think that's right. Children's health defense. And and people in the chat will probably know. And then the other one is the doctors group. Filed a suit on behalf of doctors, on behalf of patients, parents, on behalf of kids in Alabama. They didn't file actually a suit. They filed a request for an injunctive relief, which you can file a petition for that in advance of the suit itself if you want, by an old friend of mine, Larry Beecraft, who I always know as Larry used to, you know, say, you know, it's beer 30. He's like, time to get a beer. It's like, oh, it's beer 30. It's beer 30 somewhere in the world. So that was one of Larry's lines. He's from Alabama. What they're challenging is the same thing that Bobby Kennedy is challenging, just in a different way. And the argument is that the emergency use authorization standards were not met yet to authorize the vaccine for people that are under the age of 16. And it's a long, long complaint. If people want to look at all the different, they use it as an opportunity, or petition for injunctive relief. They use it as an opportunity to present a wide range of arguments. But legally, it boils down to, did the FDA and this, or the CDC, meet their requirements under the emergency use authorization statute? And that's part of it. They touch on it a little bit. If you read the emergency use authorization statutes and related statutes that are specific to kids and other aspects, some of these statutes appear to have been written for national security issues. In other words, anticipating weapons attack, chemical weapons, biological weapons. They don't quite appear to have been originally intended to deal with a pandemic necessarily. So that's one set of questions. And from that flows a whole host of regulations that it appears that they have to meet a bunch of tests. They have to say, this is the case. The big thing they're supposed to do is create a risk-benefit analysis and two levels of risk-benefit analysis. They're supposed to do an administrative process whereby they determine that the risk-benefit analysis warrants the emergency use authorization for this particular population group, people under the age of 16. And secondly, they're supposed to help produce that for the public so they meet the informed consent component, because the Nuremberg Code has been codified in these laws. And courts have recognized this, that the old Nuremberg Code 1947, after the Nuremberg trials, established the legal precedent that said international law was enforceable in this space, that we would never do experimentation. And this is, again, because this drug is an experimental drug, because it's an emergency use authorization drug. So a lot of people had questions about clinical trials and whatnot. The general rule that the FDA follows is they require usually about a year to 2 year time period before they approve new drugs, including vaccines, especially for children. And that time frame hasn't been met. So there have been clinical trials, just not of the length and the duration, so they can observe the consequences long enough in order to be able to authorize it under traditional authorization. That's why all of this is under emergency use authorization, and they're challenging not so much the idea of emergency use authorization, they're challenging or the informed consent component, because that's not the issue here. They're challenging whether or not they followed that as applied to this population group of people between the ages of 12 and 15.
And now I'll just, I mean, the suit is in the United, it's in the District of Alabama, America's Frontline Doctors, et cetera, versus the government. And it's, I mean, it's, it is a lot, it's 80 pages. It goes into a great amount of detail. There's, you know, there's quite a bit of hyperbolic rhetoric in it, which I think is,
well, it's Larry Beecraft. So Larry never holds back. That's not Larry's nature.
And so, I mean, I say it's good and it's bad. It's good in the sense that it'll get the people who support it, encouraged or invigorated. It's going to get the people who think that those people are wrong, thinking they're wrong, and they're just using certain language in general. But no, it is an amazing thing that it highlights what emergency use authorization is about, the calculations that should go into it when it comes to risk versus reward. And the lawsuit itself, a lot of the allegations focus on the fact that other than being experimental, even by the National Institute of Health standards or determinations, when the risk level for children, statistically, we know what it is. So when the risk level for children is what we know it is after a year and some of this pandemic, can it even meet the required elements in order to be qualified as emergency use for kids? And you know, we're getting to the level where it was at one point, are they going to force vaccination of adults? Are they going to make two-tiered system? I brought up a couple of chats, you know, like you can't do X, Y, and Z if you're an adult, but now if it's going to be the same thing for kids and it might not be forced, it's just going to be economically, socially compelled. And the lawsuit is seeking an injunction to immediately halt that. But Robert, where in the states are they looking to make this policy or make this, if not law, some form of requirement for children? I people know what's going on in Canada, but I didn't know that we were at this stage in the states.
The District of Columbia. So Bobby Kennedy's looking at bringing suit there. But what I thought was really intelligent, both about Bobby Kennedy's challenge and this challenge by the doctors group brought by Larry Beecraft, is there in this context, like in all the lockdown context, one of the constant complaints and concerns was the brought up by Judge Stickman in the decision that came out of the Western District of Pennsylvania. That, for those asking, yes, it's still sitting at the Third Circuit. As predicted, they were just going to sit on it, which by the way, for all those people that are highly critical of his decision, if it was so bad, they would have reversed it in full and in published opinion. They haven't. That's because they know it's not easy to do so. They're hoping it gets to the point where it's moot and they never have to deal with it. But the typical Third Circus, but that's another story for another day. But in that is that they're showing that at least in the vaccine context, a lot of the principles that should have been in the lockdown context and other public health intervention context, including mask mandates, is actually put in the law and the regulations, which is this cost risk benefit analysis that, as we know from the Judge Stickman case, they didn't do in the lockdown context in Pennsylvania. I don't believe they did it anywhere. We've seen no evidence of published evidence that they did so. But in this context, they're statutorily obligated to do it because the concern was they didn't want this to be a power grab by the CDC or the FDA. It was not a loophole meant to swallow up all the other rules and principles governing public health. And it was a careful balance between informed consent and protection of the public from a dangerous disease. And that's why it required this level of analysis. And it included also requiring them rule out that any other alternative therapeutic treatment or other public health intervention could work, including self-quarantining and so on and so forth. And so that's the concern, is that they're rushing this vaccine in ways that do not meet traditional FDA standards. And in order to do so, they have to go through other unique standards. And there isn't evidence that they have. And he's challenging whether that evidence even exists and is saying the available public evidence says otherwise. I mean, he points out that for those between the ages of 12 and 15, this is what's alleged in the petition for an injunction. And that's why it's kind of a lawsuit, but kind of not yet. They're going to be bringing a suit later on. This is a way of bringing a suit. It's just old. Larry likes a lot of these old principles, petitions for injunctive relief, so on and so forth, as opposed to a complaint for legal remedy. The old equity legal distinction, for those that may not know it, exists in Tennessee, chancery courts versus circuit courts, civil courts, et cetera. But the is that he just goes through and says, look, the risk up from the publicly available data is almost statistically 0%. It's like 0.00003 65.
If anybody sees me looking off to the side, it's because I'm getting the screenshot of the section. I'll just read it. It's an allegation, people. It's not a proven fact yet, but it will be proven or not proven. It says the balancing test required by section 360BBB3C2B cannot be satisfied. Since the risk from COVID to 12 to 15-year-old children is statistically zero, and that's not zero, rather statistically zero, meaning rounded down, it's effectively zero, there is no real or material benefit to this age category of using these experimental vaccines. At the same time, the risks of using any untested drug are always substantial. And in this case, the injections are already proving to be dangerous, even on the basis of the false and or misleading statistics promulgated by the DHHS, Department of Health and Human Services, because what they're basically saying, it's fleshed out in the allegations, not proven evidence yet. But they're basically saying they're tinkering with statistical results in order to fabricate, exaggerate, create, or if you believe it, you know, they're using statistics to inflate the effectiveness of the vaccines by how they're testing, who they're testing, and the criteria for positivity among the vaccinated, which for some reason changes from among the non-vaccinated. And so they're basically saying even by the own inflated or conflated statistics that they're producing, statistical zero risk for an age group that they want to then use its emergency use to compel, it doesn't even fly by their own precedent or their own criteria.
And why it's very important is this goes back to my debate with Dershowitz, which people can go and find on Viva's channel, which is that he recognized that there needed to be a substantial risk of severe bodily harm to be doing these activities, particularly when it gets to the coercion state. And the fear is that if they can do emergency use drugs that then are later mandated by employers or educational institutions for something that poses a risk of death of, you know, 0.0000, whatever, 3, 4, 5%, that's, you know, way under 1%, then they could do it for anything because there's all kinds of diseases that can come around that have that small, tiny level of risk. There's all kinds of activities in society that pose that level of risk. I mean, could you start to, you know, ban, you can't drive bicycles, you can't drive your own vehicle, well, you have to fairness, do this. I mean, it could keep going if this tiny level of risk allows for massive federal intervention in people's everyday lives.
I say the only distinction is you have to compare to contagious viruses, contagion versus accidents and general risk. I think that's the only...
regulatory perspective, yes. But yeah. I think the broader constitutional concern is if you could do it in this context, why couldn't you say anytime that a 0.00345% risk exists in any aspect of life, we have an obligation as a matter of national security to start to run and control your life and dictate what you can do? Because if you could do it in this context, legal, at least constitutionally, then you could do it in any other context.
And now for anybody who doesn't follow us on Locals, and this is not a cheap plug, it's just Robert put out something the other day, which I had never actually, it was a defense of the this position as relates to vaccination. And Robert brought up something which I never really thought of or fully appreciated or fully fleshed out in my own mind, which is that the risk here has to be from asymptomatic or pre-symptomatic spread, because from a legal perspective, if someone is diagnosed as having COVID, and we can all recognize that that's a serious thing, there's quarantine measures that can apply to that person such that the vaccination, A, is not useful or relevant to that point, but that there's an alternative method of dealing with it that does not involve potentially constitutional violations. So the real risk has to be asymptomatic and pre-symptomatic evidence of transmissibility to justify this policy. And then you're at a threshold that's even exponentially less than the stats as we know them, which come from actual infection. So everyone, like, let that sink in, because in order to justify any form of compelled vaccination, at least in a court of law, and Robert puts out the defense, which is playing the intellectual game, the thought experiment, it has to be that pre-symptomatic and asymptomatic spread is so substantial or sufficiently substantial that it could compel, any sort of policy as relates to vaccination. So,
in this context, if you applied that math, you're probably talking about vaccinating this group. I believe there's put it this way: the the feds have not created any cost risk benefit analysis that they've published to anybody that I know of. So, and in my view, is the evidentiary burden is on them. But even but with the available information, it is likely that this vaccine would not save any lives for that age group of 12 to 15, because the statistical odds are so small that they will, in a pre-symptomatic or asymptomatic state, spread it to someone else that causes their death, because it's substantial risk of severe bodily harm. And they're already a low risk group to begin with from getting, at least that this age group would die. So you'd have to argue we're vaccinating them to prevent transmission to someone else. And even in that context, it's going to be tiny. But the idea that anybody within this age group would die because it was spread to them because of an absence of a vaccine is literally, you know, more than one in a million is what the odds are appear to be as I've seen them. So if they have other data, they should produce that data.
42 is binary. 42 is binary is the code for asterisk. So Viva, this is your asterisk birthday, kind of appropriate. Yes, it is. Thank you. No, but Robert, okay, I want to make sure I understood this part. The argument is going to be that you need to vaccinate this group, not because of the risk of COVID harm to them, but because of the risk of COVID harm to grandma. So if they get it and transmit it along.
Potentially. I mean, right now, apparently it was initially presented as being beneficial for this group, not being beneficial for others. And so that's why the injunction request focuses on that, saying, well, as it relates to this group, the odds that this group suffers death from COVID is tiny. And particularly when it relates to alternative public health interventions, such as quarantines for those who are symptomatic. And so when you add that component, he didn't even add that component, but the evidentiary record may go there. Then you multiply that the tiny risk that already exists, and you get a much tinier risk. And it's some, and at least from that standpoint, and that's because for kids, there's separate legal additional thresholds. That it's supposed to be beneficial for the kids. We're not that you're doing it to prevent the kids from transmitting it to others, but that you're doing it to prevent kids from getting it. And that's where some of the problem applies. So I think it's a good argument. Now, whether the courts are going to care is another open question, but they needed to start the process of forcing them to comply and at least produce the evidence that they did comply. What is their cost risk benefit analysis? And does it meet the evidentiary threshold? Can it be whatever they want it to be? Are there some sort of limitations on this? Dershowitz seemed to recognize, yeah, the risk needs to be really substantial. I think I even asked him if it was like 0.1%, is that worth it? He said no. Now that's because, yeah, I mean, I don't know if he thought through that the evidence is more on my side than on his side. He, I think, assumes the risk is higher than it is, at least from the data I've seen. And my main thesis for that is if the evidence was the other way around, the government would be putting it out there. They'd be saying, here's the risk and here's why it's so high. They have stayed away from this all the way through everything they've done in the public health intervention space.
Yeah. And this is something we talked about with the VAERS reporting system. The VAERS reporting system is people report. And then,
by the way, if they lie, it's a federal crime. Unlike the fake COVID passports that they claimed was magically a federal crime, which was far from clear to me. If you lie in the VA into the VAERS database, that is a federal crime. So, I mean, that's one of the highest, unlike, for example, to certain degrees, I mean, they're discovering there's new studies that suggest they may have misrepresented or got wrong the number of hospitalizations of certain groups of people being tied to this. But if you lie about this, and generally when they've done studies, they find that the reports to the database understate the scope of the risk, that usually only 10% or less of people who experience an adverse event after this time period, again, that just says correlation, doesn't prove causation, but 90% of them never report it because they don't even connect it, they don't even relate to it, so on and so forth. So but people following that database, like Alex Berenson, again, sort of a liberal, old school establishment kind of journalist, used to be for the New York Times before he wrote spy books, is that as he's pointing out, this is off the chart. Same thing. Bobby Kennedy was banned off of Instagram for just talking about this database. So it's extraordinary. Why is everybody so scared of the information in this database if everything's so safe and effective and good for us?
Well, we're gonna get there in a second, actually. But from the legal perspective of this lawsuit, it's an 80-page injunction. I don't know how much more they can flesh out the factual basis, but from a technical, you might hear someone screaming upstairs, from a technical perspective, how does it work? Now, this was drafted as an injunction. What time frame do they have to convert this into or draft or file an additional lawsuit, which will serve as the underlying lawsuit itself?
Oh, they don't have to do that if they don't want to. And it's sort of a procedural mechanism. This is a temporary emergency preliminary injunction request. The court can rule on that without that. Now, they have to serve this, obviously, on the defendants. Defendants appear, defendants brief it, maybe evidentiary hearing, and then make a decision. The key is going to be whether they get a judge that's open-minded on this topic. Also, this is an area that has very, very little litigation record in it. And so there's not a long established record of it. And there's a bunch of other lawyers working with Larry Beecraft on this. Joey Gilbert out of Vegas, a whole bunch of people across the country representing this frontline doctors group that has expressed a lot of concern about, you know, rushing the science. Brett Weinstein has expressed the same concerns. I mean, so it's not, and they're not saying that this is the COVID vaccine is bad or anything else. They're saying there's a proper process to go through here and we're not doing it. And that's where the risk comes in. And so that's what the lawsuit raises is, hey, we're not following our own procedures to make sure we've done the right risk analysis here.
Okay. The lawsuit itself, I'm going to try. I have trouble converting PDFs into HTML so we can share them more easily. So if anybody has a hack for that, email me at david@vivafry.com so that I can convert a PDF into a link that I can share with everybody. The lawsuit is interesting. It's hyperbolic. It's inflammatory. It's shocking. It's in your face. It is, as Robert would say, walking into a courtroom and throwing bombs. I presume, you know, they're going to be able to make evidence of the meaningful aspect of this. But at the bottom, at the end of the day, a lot of the allegations are that there's no evidence to justify what is being required, which is the inversion of, you know, effectively that's the way it needs to go. Prove that what you're doing is justified on all these levels. And until such time as you do, don't compel people, let alone children, to do certain things. Agree with it or disagree with it. That's the nature of the lawsuit. Time frame for this? Because what is the time frame for the implementation of the policies that are at the, you know, at the core of the lawsuit itself?
I mean, they already did. They just they filed the suit almost immediately, as soon as they said that they were going to do emergency use authorization for that age group, and so based on that is why they filed the suit when they did, and that's why they're seeking emergency relief. They don't want it to be authorized for that age group. And so we'll see whether the court could say okay to that and then have a hearing on other aspects of things. So, you know, there is some leeway with the court. But I hope the court takes seriously that what they're raising is that they're not following the process by which we can have confidence in the outcome, and that there's contrary evidence to suggest that process would refute the outcome they've come to. And on both grounds, I think it's a well-grounded case. It's will the court listen or care in this space when it's something they're unaccustomed to dealing with, and they often defer to the public health authorities in the pandemic environment.
And now, actually, I want to get into another technicality about Robert F. Kennedy's. Now, he's filed, it's not a lawsuit, it's a petition, and I don't understand the procedural mechanism that he's going through, what its limitations are and what its benefits are.
So what is Kennedy understands very, very well the entire process of this thing intimately. He was the one who first told me that there's an emergency use authorization limitations that should be applicable here. And that was the first time I had heard of that. And it's because he understands all the internal process. So it's a way to try to go directly to the source. And you have a right to bring a citizen's petition on certain grounds to challenge an emergency use authorization vaccine for, in this case, children. And because his group represents children, that's his focal point. So, you know, he's not going to be bringing suit for adults because that isn't part of his group that he represents, the Children's Health Defense. So that's why he brought the action. So it's a way to go directly to the regulatory agency and force them to address it. There's different ways they can avoid it, different ways they can respond to it, but their failure to respond can be used as additional grounds to bring suit or support existing suits.
Now, is there a threshold of signatures that it requires? Is there a threshold of anything, or can any interested party file the petition?
He's definitely brought it the procedurally correct way. I don't know all the details of that. I just know he knows that process better than anybody.
Okay. And now we smoke Bitcoin. So I can tell you one thing. I'm an idiot. I got into, I don't know, this might get the YouTube thing is going. I thought, you know, I'll buy it a dip. Yeah, that dip is now twice what it was when I bought like a fraction of a Bitcoin just so I could say, I can follow with eager eyes now. But anyways, all I say, we smoke Bitcoins. Thank you very much for the 142. I'm trying to find the meaning to that number. Oh, 42. Okay, good enough. Okay, so and the time frame for RFK's response, are there strict regular, like are there strict timelines that they have to respect, or can they drag their feet and force a party to go to court?
That part of the process, I don't know. So I just know the people would have to research it because I don't know the intricacies of it. I just know that if he's filed it, he has confidence that it can produce a positive outcome one way or the other.
Okay, now this might be a good segue because I like the idea of encouraging public discourse is the surest way to foment trust in the process and trust in the results. And what we are doing, and I say we to include myself, not to point fingers, what we are doing as a society by not engaging in this public discourse, by demonizing it, by demonetizing it, and by depersoning it is the exact opposite. One can and when you do that, people are going to wonder why you're doing it. So you can come to whatever reasons you think that that's being done, whether it's greed, whether it's just to make sure you're making profits, or whether it's because they know that it's not justified, whatever. You can come to those conclusions on your own. But one thing is for certain, when the process goes like that, people are going to wonder. And when people stifle free speech, that's when it happens. Now, interesting lawsuit you sent me. This one is about a I'll pull up the details in a second, but it's about a legislation regarding counseling and what counselors are allowed to discuss with their patients. Now, when Robert sends me my homework, and sometimes I have no backdrop, I have no context. And so I started reading this lawsuit, which was basically challenging a law that would limit what counselors can advise with their patients, young patients, as relates to sexual orientation, gender identity, et cetera, et cetera. Not knowing anything of the context, I thought that this was going to be, I thought it might have been coming from a conservative state that was going to limit a counselor's ability to discuss these issues in the sense of, you know, the positive affirmation side of it, the coping with gender identity issues. And with, you know, and as I'm reading through this, I'm like, I think I have a problem with this, even if I might disagree with some of the other bigger policy issues about allowing children to do certain things to their bodies. The discussion aspect, I would have a problem with if the government were saying you cannot discuss this when a kid going through it is bringing it up. Then I got a little further into it. And I realized it's the exact opposite way around, where it's policymakers basically saying to a faith, he's not a faith-based counselor, but he is a Christian counselor who says, I want to try to talk to my children, patients about this and help them through it without it going to the next level, which is where people have big problems with it. So when I first thought it was the other side, I was like, okay, well, I still have a problem with stifling free speech. And then I realized it was the other way around. And that's how I sort of can feel confident that I can see it objectively. But the policy effectively limits a counselor's ability to discuss certain things with their patients as relates to transgenderism, homosexual tendencies, beliefs, ideologies, tendencies more so. And it prohibits the counselor from what they called, I think in the lawsuit called pray the gay away, which is one of the old expressions that people use to demonize religious people who tried to, you know, who ostensibly were trying to get people to stop being that way. But this is a Christian counselor who now sees legislation coming into effect that would prohibit him from having certain discussions, not all the discussions, only the discussions to talk a person through it or out of it, for lack of a better way of putting it, as opposed to talking them through it and into it, which seems to be tolerated. And so I hope I've described that lawsuit properly enough, but it's a legislation basically that says you can't discuss trying to talk someone out of it, but counselors can continue to discuss talking someone into it. And so this person, I forget the name now, but they filed a lawsuit on the basis of First Amendment violations. I think it was a viewpoint-based discrimination in that the lawsuit didn't say you can't talk about any of it. They said you can't talk about part of it based on your viewpoint discrimination. Did I do a good enough job with that, Robert?
Yeah. I mean, basically the state of Washington, in an effort to ban what's called conversion therapy, banned people even discussing anything that could get anywhere close to it. Basically, if you're a counselor and somebody comes to you and expresses anything about sexual identity or gender identity, all you can do is affirm the transition, affirm the alternative behavior. You can't say or do anything that suggests, okay, maybe that's not who you really are. Maybe what you're going through relates to something else. Maybe it's not who somebody comes to them and says they don't want to have that behavior, or they find the behavior problematic in some other way, or maybe they're married and consequently other things. So whatever the circumstances may be, in the name of prohibiting conversion therapy, which is really prohibiting religious expression as well, they have basically prohibited any statements. It's two things. There's a prohibition on what you can say. There's a prohibition on what the patient can ask for. And there's coercive, compelled speech. You're forced to say certain things. And the patient is forced to say certain things. So not only are they invading the privacy of a doctor-patient, counselor-patient, therapeutic relationship, but they're prohibiting certain speech and compelling other speech. And they've also brought a Fifth Amendment challenge because the standards they have are ridiculously vague. It basically says, if you don't, you better guess what's politically correct. And if you don't, we're going to take your license away.
And here, I'm going to read a passage. I don't like screen share. If people think screen share would be beneficial, I find it boring, but 7,300 in the chat, only 2,000 likes. We can fix that now. But while you fix that, let me just read this section. It says, the counseling censorship law added, quote, performing conversion therapy on a client under age 18, end quote, to the list of conduct, acts, or conditions that would constitute unprofessional conduct to the license holder. Marriage and family therapists are among those deemed to be covered license holders under the definition of the law. Conversion therapy, quoted, is defined in terms that are vague, content-based, and biased against one perspective or point of view, and it defines it. Conversion therapy means a regime that seeks to change an individual's sexual orientation or gender identity. The term includes efforts to change behaviors or gender expressions or to eliminate or reduce sexual or romantic attractions or feelings toward individuals of the same sex. The term includes, but is not limited to, practices commonly referred to as reparative therapy. And so what's amazing is reading the first half of that, you could read that in the exact politically ideologically opposite sense, that they're prohibiting someone from encouraging someone to change their gender or their identity. It's when you get to the second part of it that it basically says, no, it's the exact opposite. Even if the person comes to you and says, yeah, effectively, help me. I want to be a certain way, or I just want to discuss it and help me get through this. They've tied their hands, and they've tied their hands in the sense that from what the lawsuit alleges, anonymous complaints can be made that can result in the license being revoked from this counselor. Anonymous complaints for non-compliance. I mean, it's beyond thought police. It's almost before that. It's Minority Report thought language police that you can't even get into the discussion. And how are they supposed to treat their patients? And it limits the counselor's speech and the patients to some extent.
No doubt. It's what we've been discussing for a while, is increasing use by the state of their licensure controls, which are effectively occupational controls, to dictate they become agents of the state to promote a certain ideological point of view, and to do so even in relationships of trust and confidence. So that, you know, you go in, you think you're talking to a therapist, you're really talking to an agent of the state who is being told, who has to tell you which direction you can take. You can't use all the therapeutic options. It's not limited by what the DSM-IV, DSM-V5 says, not limited by scientific restrictions. It's the state saying, no, you can only promote this and you can only discourage that. And that's it. Regardless of whether that's good or bad for the individual under the circumstances. No individual assessment either. It's this is good, this is bad, that's it. Even though there's people who are bringing suit now in the UK and elsewhere on grounds that the advice to transition with the physical treatment, the medical treatment, and medical interventions that went with it did severe harm and violated their informed consent requirements. They're basically forcing people to counselors to only recommend the kind of treatment that's getting doctors sued in different parts of the world because of its medically problematic characteristics, because a lot of it is experimental and sort of similar overlap in that context with the COVID public health intervention questions. So it's a suit that should win It's in the state of Washington. It's a federal court. Who knows? Unfortunately, in those courts, but it's a case that should win because it's compelled speech. It should win just on void for vagueness grounds. When you create rules that you have to guess what they mean, then that's void for vagueness grounds under the due process clause. But it should also be struck down on First Amendment grounds.
And here's another passage. It says, it is revealing to note that the Washington legislature also rejected an amendment that would have specifically exempted counseling that would have been, quote, consistent with the client's affirmatively stated goals or objectives. And people have to appreciate how over the top this is, because this is something that you would have to agree with regardless of how you feel about gender transitioning and all of these other issues, you know, even with kids. Regardless of how you feel about this, to say that you are going to basically limit the professional advice that a patient can get from their professional, their counselor, it's nothing less than that. It is nothing less than saying the counselor has to give you a specific answer to a specific query, regardless of their belief and regardless of their professional opinion. And it's egregious because typically, if a patient is getting advice that they don't agree with or they don't like, or they don't like, you know, the pressure they feel from their counselor, you go get another counselor, you go get another cognitive behavioral therapist, or you go get another whatever. But to make the therapist basically promote a theory, notwithstanding their professional training, you may as well just be going, like you say, just go to the government, have a congressman tell you what you should do. It's preposterous. There seems to be no limit, but, you know, luckily we've seen the first two cases we talked about today. The courts are setting some limits. This seems over the top, but I say this in Canada, where we know what happened to the father who was protesting his child's gender reassignment surgery at age 12, 13, you know, made some public statements, defied some court orders, and is now in jail for 6 months for contempt for making public statements about a case, notwithstanding a publication ban and a discussion ban. What do you say? What other states have tried to implement anything like this? Have other states followed suit or not yet?
You know, to be honest with you, I don't know. I know there's some states were discussing it, but until I saw this suit, I didn't realize state of Washington had actually passed it. So the, credit for them to fight it. They should win. Doesn't mean they will win. But I find it very frightening, this misuse of leveraging licensures. That's why I'm not a big fan of state licensures in general. Require honesty in advertising. Don't require licensing. I think that for lawyers. I think that for doctors. I think that for everything. Let me know. Let any ordinary individual hang out their shingle like it was during the days of Andy Jackson, and I can make my own decision. Ordinary people can make their own decision. And so it's just a way to – it was initially a way to inflate salaries. Now, in my view, it's a way to create, to indoctrinate, to use that as like a priest license of the state. And you're supposed to only endorse the ideas the state says you can. So it's deeply problematic.
It's the state usurping the powers of independent professionals. Hip poopy. My opinion about gender issues is irrelevant. If a person needs professional discussion, the discussion should not be restricted from being honest. There's no question. And it is effectively just now it's the state taking over private counseling, if nothing less than that. What was the thought that I just had 2 seconds ago? Oh, yes, that's right. I was going to say, and as far as bar licenses goes, people should appreciate my Quebec bar license costs, I think it's 3,000, give or take, 2,500 to 3,000 a year. That's just so I can practice. Then you got to make that money back to pay for your license. But setting aside that, you know, they tax you so that they can then fund the bar society and pay the salaries of the employees who govern your practice, who investigate you and whatever. We've seen, as far as competence goes, excessively low competence representation from licensed lawyers. And we've seen some amazing representation from pro se litigants and from individuals who do it on their own and learn themselves, who could very well, you know, be better lawyers than most certified lawyers. So I've never given it much thought, but you make a good point. It's like, just announce that you're not licensed, that you are self-taught, let people come to you if they want, and then, you know, see how the practice works. It would certainly eliminate a lot of the coercion that you see, that we've seen weaponized and politicized.
No doubt about it. And I mean, they, at least to transition to another topic, they would be, you can see what kind of skill level is needed or necessary for certain positions, because this week the prison guards in the Epstein case,
oh my goodness,
are going to plead guilty. Go ahead.
I mean, you sent me the article. I hadn't been following it. The prison guards, they're going to plead guilty to filing false records as relates to their what was supposed to be 30-minute supervision of Jeffrey Epstein. The article that you sent me, Robert, I mean, it's not called bearing the lead. It's called framing the discussion or framing the article. Everything that that article, every way in which that article was drafted was Epstein defied the second or first eternal truth that he did not take his own, that he did bona fide take his own life. It's a foregone conclusion. It's all drafted around that. In the first paragraph, they mention that fact twice. And so the entire foregone conclusion is that this is all the unfortunate result of two overworked employees of a federal prison system that is understaffed, overworked. They're working their second 8-hour shift in the day, overtime, yada, yada, yada. They're sleeping on the job because they work so hard. There is not an iota of suspicion, of questioning the narrative. It is just, the narrative is he ended his own life. And the only reason it happened was because he was left alone, because these federal prison systems are understaffed, overworked, and these crooked guards falsified their reports that they had to be checking on Epstein every 30 minutes. And they didn't, allegedly. They're going to plead guilty and probably get community service. And that's it. Everyone can carry on with your day. I mean, first of all, I know nothing about the federal prison system in the United States. Is it as grossly underfunded? Is it as dilapidated as this article makes it sound that it is, such that everyone's just working 25 hours a day?
That's completely false. So he was in a federal detention center. So that's not run by the Bureau of Prisons generally. That's run by the United States Marshals. The Marshals run it. Now, they staff it with their own people, but that's actually, you're in the Marshals' custody when you're awaiting trial. And the entire excuse to detain people pre-trial is that they have great health services, that they're completely safe facilities, that violence never happens, that they have a very professional staff, they're given lots of cash. And so, in fact, the federal system is much more protective than the state system is. This is nothing like state jails or state prisons. And ask anybody who's ever been detained. They would much rather be in a federal detention center than be either even in a federal prison, definitely than a state jail or state prison. So these are highly professionalized places. To give an example, that place in MDC in Manhattan had not had a suicide in, I believe, a quarter of a century. So that gives you an idea for how the system is protective. They'd actually designed the prison cells so that it was near impossible to commit suicide. Designed the sheets and clothing to be ripoff so that you couldn't do it. Had cameras right on the cell of high-risk defendants so that you would be watching it and observing it. And had people observing it. And I've done, you know, wrongful suicide cases, other cases. So I know what these rules are. It's in the state system, it's nowhere near as good as the federal system. It's extremely rare to hear this happening in the federal system. So this looks like a plea deal that is getting justice for what happened. It's actually a plea deal that is a cover up for what happened. As long as these two people agree to the official narrative that they just fell asleep and then lied about it later, because the problem was,
I was just going to say, and set aside the findings of the coroner. I mean, setting aside that, where everything you've just described, on its face, to most reasonably cynical people who have an iota of understanding of how things work, would be laughably implausible on its face. And call us conspiracy theories. When you can predict the future and then the future happens, you can say it's a question of, you know, a fluke or whatever, or it's just so predictable that it's undeniable. And give Stix Hexenhammer some credit, because I think everyone was predicting it, but he was predicting it loudly. But when it happens, and then you have all of these excuses coming into play as to how this could happen, setting aside the most least talked about fact about all of this, the coroner report itself, which came to a determination, unless I'm wrong, Robert, correct me if I'm wrong, that the indications were more in line with an act of one's hands as opposed to an act of a rope. In terms of crushing certain parts of the trachea, I think, or the clavicle. I think it was the clavicle. There was a setting all
he
this-
had injuries on his face, his body, and his neck that was not consistent with suicide under the circumstances present here. But if you're going to uncover this, the weak link were these two officers, because they were supposed to be on duty. They're supposed to observe it. Maybe they did. Maybe they helped facilitate it. They would be the ones to know. They would be the ones that might have been paid off or blackmailed into whatever happened. They were the weak link to the, if there was a conspiracy to kill Epstein. By letting them plead and serve no jail time at all and just walk free based on pushing the cover-up narrative, tells you that they're going to cover this up for good. That's all they're going to do. They're not pursuing anything further. It's all nothing to see here, everybody. And as you pointed out, you know that's true by how the narrative is being spun. When they keep repeating it, don't worry, Epstein killed himself. Eternal truth number two, Epstein didn't kill himself. You're still mute.
I'm sorry, that's because I had to cough and I didn't want to start any rumors. Okay, hold on. I just got to read. The first paragraph is, oh, son of a bee stink, where is it? Oh, I may have to find it later. Oh, I was sure. The first paragraph lays the brickwork. How is it that it could happen that Epstein was allowed to kill himself? It frames the discussion, so you don't even question the premise of the article. But everyone here watching questions the premise of the article. Call us whatever names you want. There's the only difference between conspiracy theorist and critical thinker is in the confession through projection of the accuser. Boom, shakalaka. That's going on the cup one day. But a serious question, and it's a concerning question. What's going on with Ghislaine Maxwell, and how does this reflect on, her future?
Dollars to donuts, they'll cut a sweetheart plea. Not real sweetheart, but they'll cut a plea deal with her that keeps it all quiet. That nothing will ever come out publicly. That's where this is heading.
And this is how our community, gets the truth. It was a fractured high old bone. Which was more consistent with a certain act than another act. So come to your own conclusion.
Yes, exactly. It's not, I mean, put it this way, I know this stuff backwards and forwards. I had people like Beyond the Law or whatever, block me because I was saying that their opinions that this was suicide don't make sense. I mean, I've done these cases for 20 years in state facilities. So, and I have a bunch of clients that have been inside federally. So, I know this landscape very well, including in New York, they've been detained. So the idea that this could, as soon as it happened, I was like, there's no way that happened the way they're trying to say it did. But the cover up is in full gear, and it's now wrapped up with a nice tidy bow.
All right. Well, Neanderthal says, to be fair, I've worked in prisoner suicide. I've worked in a. I'll slow down.
Oh, sure, they can be creative, but the problem here is they designed this facility so that that couldn't happen. And amazingly, all the precautionary supervisory components just vanished. And the official story now is going to be the camera just malfunctioned and the supervisors just fell asleep. If you buy that, I got a couple of bridges in Brooklyn to sell you.
The injuries were more consistent with one conclusion than another. The cameras, which are supposed to be 24/7.
And it wasn't hanging yourself from paper sheets that cut off when you try to. People should study. It'll be kind of like the OJ case, which we'll get into later. That if you really dig into the government's narrative, it requires the most ridiculous storyline possible. And the evidence just doesn't substantiate it or conform to it.
Injuries inconsistent with the cause of death. Two cameras malfunctioning. 24/7 surveillance not there. You would have to be willfully blind not to understand what's going on. And there's no discussion that can be had, because at some point people are just shutting off the critical thought part of their brain. If they're saying, I believe that it was one of those exceptional cases where that thyoid bone broke through a rope. I believe the cameras didn't work and they don't have any video footage. I believe that the guards who are supposed to be checking every 30 minutes, this is not, I don't want to say Joe Schmo. This is not nobody. This is public enemy number one, keep protected at all costs. They had to visit him every 30 minutes. Oh, no.
How did both guards manage to fall asleep at the right time?
They had to have two.
They
worked an eight-hour shift.
Because they
worked a double overtime. They're so tired. So help me God. I can't fall asleep during the day, period. But you fall asleep for 1 minute, 2 minutes because you doze off. It's laughable. It's laughable. And the ultra laughable thing is people like us having this discussion somehow get demonized for having the discussion. But we'll see. What do we move on to now, Robert? I'm looking at the list.
So the College of the Ozarks. So one place where the Biden administration won, at least preliminarily, was they're requiring a small Christian college open up their locker rooms and showers and bathrooms by gender self-identification rather than biological gender. They filed suit saying that is a misapplication of Title IX and is a violation of their religious rights. And so the court approved it. The court said the Biden administration, that's just fine. I find the ruling problematic. I find the policy problematic. They're going to appeal it. And I think the upside is this way they get to take this issue up to the Court of Appeals. And it's the kind of issue that the Supreme Court almost took this a couple of years ago. It creates an opportunity for the Supreme Court to clarify in this space what Title IX means and doesn't mean, what religious rights mean and don't mean. And one area where this court has been good has been, generally speaking, has been on church-related rights. And so I'm hopeful that this is one of those cases that gets up there, because I found the district court ruling very problematic to compel. As a whole, the idea that gender self-identification is supposed to be covered by Title IX, it strikes me as ridiculous. The whole point of Title IX was to protect biological gender. And now it means that biological men can participate in women's sports. Doesn't make sense.
Robert, some people ask me the question. I genuinely don't know the answer. And it's not one of those tongue-in-cheek type sarcastic, sassy questions. Even assuming Title IX is to extend to protect gender identity, at what point does a biological, I forget which one is which, XX or XY, at what point does a biological male identifying as a biological female get recognition, protection under Title IX? Like, is it overnight? Do they have to go through certain procedures before they get recognition? Do they have to have, I'm not saying this to be funny, do they have to have testosterone levels below a certain threshold before the protection applies? Like, is it a willy-nilly protection, or is there any form of agree or disagree?
Purely biological self-identification under the Biden administration's policies, my understanding. It's not biological. It's just self-identification. Nothing else is required. No level of biological change or transition has to have occurred, is my understanding. Purely self-identification.
Okay. That's where it just becomes such an issue of, you purport to be protecting someone's rights while simultaneously destroying the very rights of the group that was supposed to be protected by Title IX. It's like, if it's overnight, if it's within 6 months, whatever. If the idea now is that you're protecting the rights of what is, I think it's objectively less than 1% of the population, and that's not to say that percentage determines protection, but you're protecting 1% less of the population to the detriment. The effects of this protection are magnified in the domains where it's applied, because it's not just because it's 1% versus 50% gender identity versus female. In the fields where it's going to be carried out, the effect, as we've seen it, is going to be total domination. 1-2 in Ohio track. And so in protecting 1%, or what you think is protecting 1%, you are effectively denying the rights of 50%. In a manner that is going to have disproportionate effects on them in all relevant fields. I don't understand how anybody comes to that conclusion that it's justifiable, even if they identify a problem. And I just don't know how have the courts historically interpreted Title IX, and what are the historical precedent what's going to be the impact faced with this proposed change?
Obama administration did the same thing. They used Title IX to create a moral panic about camp rapes on campus and created their own quasi-court system that circumvented the entire rule of law and ended up violating due process all the way across the board. And it appears they're leveraging it again, this time to remake the ideas that are permitted on college campuses, even religious schools, such that men can go into women's bathrooms, men can go into women's locker rooms, men can go into women's showers. that this creates a whole host of problems. And the idea that you won't get anybody that does so on a prank or anything else is that you're not going to be able to completely prohibit that now. And it just offends the values that these small Christian schools have. So it's a war on a part of the culture that has a different set of viewpoints about this, leveraging Title IX in a way that Title IX was clearly, in my view, never intended. And so it's the legal warfare, taking culture warfare and making it legal warfare. And it's comparable to the Washington case. It's forcing even religious schools to have the values of the Biden administration.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. The urinals, I mean, I've always been on the fence with, I mean, in a more literal sense than usual with the urinals, because in Europe, you have gender-neutral bathrooms more, you know, or you just, there's no gender bathroom.
But I was a little shocked when I went in there. I was like, man, it's like something out of medieval age. I don't know what that is. Is a hole in the ground? What the?
Setting aside, well, and then you share the bathrooms with all
genders. By contrast, Japanese bathrooms by far the best. They know what they're doing, the Japs.
Robert, I've never been to Japan, and if I never get there, we'll see. I mean, my wife got there once. I have been dying to go. It's my bucket list, but we'll see. No,
sushi's amazing. They rank their Kobe steak there. So I had the 9th best ranked steak in the entire country, which was really 9th best steak in the world. You could cut it with a spoon.
Tabarnouche. One day, I had genuine Kobe, not Wagyu, but genuine Kobe at a Park restaurant in Montreal, Antonio Park's restaurant. It cost $140 it was like 3 ounces. And it was the most delicious thing I've ever had. But we were sitting next to a couple who were looking at us. And I said, there's no way to eat something like this and not share it with somebody who has never tasted it and probably never would. And so we gave him a piece. We figured each slice cost about $16. It was delicious, but you can't eat too much of it because it'll give you diarrhea. That's for sure. But no, what were we saying? I forget. No, exactly what we were talking about. I just lost my thought. What were we talking about, Robert?
We were just the College of Ozarks. I think that wraps up the College of the Ozarks case. But hopefully it will go up and get better results on appeal and maybe even be a Supreme Court case. Because I find with the Richard Barris of People's Pundit Daily has pulled this precise topic. And 75% to 80% of the country disagrees with these rules. And when you say it's a small religious school, my guess is that goes up to 80% to 85%. This is an idea that's only popular amongst the wokester Twitterati, not with the ordinary person at all. And it's a place where the courts are badly out of step by just that. And this is something that would have been a parody in Babylon Bee or The Onion or South Park 10 years ago. Now it's law of the land, according to a federal judge and the Biden administration.
It was the bathroom. No, it was the someone reminded me, it was the bathrooms. The idea that, you know, going into a bathroom where you're still in a unique stall, it's embarrassing, it's a little uncomfortable, and maybe just that's because I know what I do in a bathroom. You know, I don't like doing things in public bathrooms, period. But there's a massive difference between a bathroom and a changing room. There's a massive difference between, you know, a locker room and a bathroom, where even if you go into one common room, there's different stalls. And there's a massive difference between a bathroom at a restaurant and a changing room or at a religious institution. It is, you try not to think cynically or conspiratorially, but it literally is as though it's trying to strip the essential elements of that which made religious institutions religious. If you don't like it, don't go. But you don't have to destroy it, even if you don't go, because you know whether or not you agree with their beliefs and you consider it to be bigoted or whatever. Religion is among the oldest things and you have to respect it. If you don't like it, don't go. But don't try to impose laws that force these religious institutions to deny their most basic tenets of their religion. I mean, that's the bottom line. You don't have to like it. You don't have to participate in it. You don't have to destroy it. So, I mean, we'll see. What circuit appeal is it going to go to for people who don't know, and what's the reputation of that circuit?
It's either the Sixth Circuit or the Eighth Circuit. I'm not sure which, but these days, a lot of the circuits are split. Even the Ninth Circuit now is increasingly split, so that you have the DC circuit, which is very democratic, but I don't think any other circuit necessarily is. So it's, you know, they lean, it all depends on the panel. It's sort of luck of the draw.
All right. And now let's, I know people are dying to know. We're going to get into the criminal side of this week's discussion. Let's start with Rittenhouse, because we haven't heard anything about this in a while. First of all, what you can discuss and only what you can discuss. What's the status? What's the update?
So he appeared in court this week because they were tightening down the schedule for when motions will be filed, when juror questionnaires will be filed. His trial is set now for November. Probably be a several-week trial, might go a month. There are additional lawyers announced there. Those lawyers have been part of the team for a while. And, in fact, there's an advisory team that I'm putting together that are giving advice, and probably a lot of people would know them. But for now, you know, I'll let them disclose when they want to as to their role and their involvement. But so the as to the whole case, so that and there's already other work afoot on the investigative side and the other side. So the continuing to expand that, it's going to be a obviously a critical case. Prosecution continues to march forward. And so you don't have to be sort of, you know, fully prepped and prepared. Building a big jury selection team as well, because that's going to be, as the Chauvin case revealed, critical. But so there were some, and then the media repeated some lies, but they can get away with those lies for the time being until the trial happens. If he is acquitted like he should be, then can seek remedy in that space. Still have ongoing problems with John Pierce. You know, he's hiding money, appears to have stolen money, is doing the same shenanigans. You know, Lynn Wood's people are not being as helpful as they could be on that side of the equation. That's unfortunate. Might have to end up bringing suit against John Pierce. He's actually trying to demand more money now after he did scams to begin with. So, you know, it is what it is. It's what I said about those individuals turned out true and then some, and we're going to continue to seek remedy, but the continuing to ramp up the defense at every single level to make sure he has a dream team caliber defense at every capacity of the case, from investigation to the court of public opinion to jury selection to the trial itself, and any motions that might be brought correspondent there too. But so that's the main update.
All right. Now, before I bring up this comment, because I do want to ask the question, I was just talking with someone earlier today, and I said, you, Robert, we live on the internet. We say things that can never be taken down. So when you make predictions, if they're wrong, they're out there. You can't take them back. I've made a bunch of predictions that have turned out to be very wrong, and I like to tout them because it shows that I'm fallible. I was telling this person that you have been ahead of the curve on a number of issues, not just a number of issues, but a number of issues where being that far ahead of the curve was the least probable or very unlikely outcome at the time. And, you know, this is one of them in terms of John Pierce and Lynn Wood and the fundraising and the problems with that. You called it out before the problem existed. And it's not to stroke your ego. It's just to say, like, yeah, people make predictions. When you make them publicly online, they don't go away. And when you make bad ones, they're rubbed in your face. And when you make good ones, they're out there for everyone to see. And you've been on with a lot of this. This is the question I wanted to get to, because people don't ask. And not sometimes they don't ask. Sometimes they just assume that Rittenhouse somehow gets, you know, not satisfaction, but rather vindication from being victimized by the media. And, you know, he's sacrificing himself for Second Amendment rights across the country. Or, you know, Jordan Peterson suffering for the benefit of everyone. But these people suffer, like Julian Assange. And there's no real joy in being the victim of this. How is he doing personally on an individual level, if you know?
Yeah, there's two aspects. I mean, a lot of the media has misrepresented him as, you know, a militia guy, a vendetta guy, a vengeance guy, someone who is proud or smirking, you know, kind of like the Covington kid misrepresentations. He would much rather not be here. I mean, he's a kid who, you know, spent his first 2 weeks throwing up in response to what happened. Didn't want any deaths to occur. No, nothing like that. Just wanted to try to take care of people and protect people. I mean, the best way you can describe Kyle Rittenhouse is half of him wants to be a police officer, and half wants to be a nurse. I mean, why? Because the things that tie those things together, being protective of others, particularly vulnerable others. And that's who the kid is. And so he was horrified and traumatized by everything that took place. Now, as self-defense experts have noted, he exercised extraordinary patience, extraordinary discipline, extraordinary restraint in his course of conduct that day. There are people that are using what he did as films to show, here's how you restrain yourself when it's very difficult in a high stress circumstances where it might be easy to get trigger happy. He was just the opposite. I mean, literally is waiting to the last possible second until his life is in imminent risk of severe harm before he does anything, which is a credit to him. But But all these media lies about, you know, the arrogance and happy and vengeful, all of that is complete gibberish and complete nonsense. On the flip side, you know, his focus is just keeping his life as good a shape as it can be, educationally, personally, mental health, physical health, recovering from all of this, the public trauma of this, and getting prepared for trial. So, you know, a kid who's more mature, much more mature for his age than you would expect. But, you know, he's thrown into the middle of a situation where there's a lot of lions who want to tear him apart. And it's only the protection of the people that has been like God in the Daniel in the lion's den to keep him from suffering that harm. And these corrupt prosecutors continue to go afield and continue to march on with their corrupt behavior. So that's going to be a battle of the century kind of case.
And now, I mean, I'm presuming that the not the example, but rather the illustration you gave of him throwing up for the first 2 weeks of this was not something he made up. Like, this is a kid, and this is another thing people don't fully appreciate. There's a lot of internet warriors, and I'm saying that actually non-judgmentally. A lot of people who support Second Amendment rights, self-defense, I would have done the same thing, who don't know what it's like to have actually killed someone, even if they deserved it, and to actually have done what he did, even if it was in total self-defense, and I won't say guilt that you live with or remorse, just nausea of the fact that it's the ultimate thing, really. There's nothing more extreme than that in the world, even if it's totally justified and totally warranted. And this is how old was he at the time again? 17?
17. So he's someone who's never experienced anything like this before, thrown into a war zone in the middle of it. And the biggest lie the media keeps telling is who these people were. I mean, that audience, that crowd that night was filled with dangerous, violent felons waging war on the city of Kenosha for a politicized narrative that was utterly fictitious, fraudulent, and false. And the community tried to defend itself. And the kid who comes from that community, where he's part of, Kenosha extends into that part of Illinois. You're part of Kenosha, effectively. Everybody that knows anything about that area knows that. It's another place where the media lies a lot. The Young Turks lies a lot about this. And the would try to protect itself the best it could after a night of having their property destroyed. Because contrary to what a lot of these nitwits say in the media, often there is no insurance against arson. There is often no insurance against riots. So there's no place you can sue. There's no place you can get remedy. Your business is destroyed forever. Done, finished. And so people that tried to come to the defense of that community, and frankly, a lot of people were too scared to do so, and I would understand why, quite reasonable. But the people that tried to come to the protection of that community were assaulted and attacked and targeted for assault. And, you know, I mean, some of these people were some of the nastiest, most vicious criminals scum around.
Anybody who knows the circumstances knows who the three victims, for lack of a victims, were in this case.
Three criminals. That's who they were. Three criminals who were violent, who behaved violent, who tried to attack a kid for simply defending his community and trying to protect his community. That an honest prosecutor would have prosecuted them, but there isn't an honest prosecutor in Kenosha right now.
I'll say this out loud, by the way. Spam and outright threats get banned. So I blocked, and I hate doing it. So don't do it. We see the chat putting it up 15 times every. Doesn't help the message get across. It just distracts.
There's a transition into interesting legal events. Just a brief story. Apparently, somebody who's a fan decided that I needed to be their lawyer, and so they have apparently are trying to sue me to force me to be their lawyer, which is new,
Robert.
They did send apologies in advance. They said, "Please don't sue me back." So, by the way, that's not a good effective way to get me to be your lawyer. That creates a professional conflict of interest that prohibits me from being your lawyer. So just word of the wise, please don't sue me to try to make me your lawyer.
I once actually had to withdraw from a file and then was subpoenaed by the client for whom I prepared the proceedings to appear as a witness for that and to compel me to represent and not withdraw from the file. Yet, I mean, I appreciate people don't know the most tactful ways to go about things, but freedom of choice and freedom of association, it applies even to lawyers and their clients. And you can't coerce someone into anything because it doesn't work that way. We got Cleopatra's in the house. Happy birthday, David. And thank you, Robert, for the great hush-hush today. We all voted to spring you, David. Oh, yeah. Well, I'll take a fly fishing rod. I mean, I'm not taking that. I'm not asking for gifts. I'm going to get myself a fly fishing rod if my wife didn't already get me one. Cause apparently it's more relaxing, and apparently I need to relax and disconnect apparently. But no, Robert, this is a good segue talking about bad legal strategies. Okay. I read the article you sent me of the lawyer representing some of the January 6th rioters, and I'm going to call them rioters. I'm not calling them insurrectionists, especially not in light of some additional video footage that we've seen. It was a riot. We can agree on that for the most part. The lawyer representing some of them has used terms that we cannot repeat here because it is bad words. But the lawyer representing some of the rioters who were arrested basically referred to them as the only term I'm going to use is the short bus, because I don't believe the short bus means what people think it means. It doesn't refer to mentally challenged. It refers to a secondary bus that was going to school and maybe had learning disabilities. I don't know. But the short bus, I never even understood as referring to intelligence or any disabilities, just the different bus. But he referred to them, his own clients, as short bus and a number of other effing expletives and attacking their intelligence, but also in using words that have not been permissible since Tropic Thunder was released. Now, before anyone poops on the lawyer, you know, you can understand a lawyer saying, this is the strategy we're going to adopt. I was going to say kids, but clients. I'm going to throw you under the bus in the sense that I'm going to throw you under the bus by throwing Trump under the bus, by saying you were naive babes in the woods who fell for the propaganda. You were so unintelligent and corruptible yourselves that you couldn't but have been convinced by 4 years of propaganda, 4 years of lies of Trump. And so you're not to blame. He's to blame. And you're not to blame because you are so unintelligent. You are so mentally deficient. You are so effing whatever that you can't be held legally responsible for the consequences of your own actions, even assuming they are what they are. I responded to it, I said, it's a bold strategy, Cotton. We'll see if it pays off. It's terrible, but that's the rationale. I think it's just terrible that this lawyer thinks this is the way to protect your clients by throwing them under the bus and making them look like bigger victims, as opposed to just defending them. But I know nothing about this lawyer. Is this like a runaway juror as a lawyer? Or is this a lawyer who just took this strategy and it's totally going to backfire?
I think it reflects the political bias of lawyers, particularly those that are public defenders and that are what's called CJA lawyers that are appointed on a panel, especially in the District of Columbia. So first, they're lawyers. Second, they're public defender or CJA lawyers mostly. And third, they're in the District of Columbia. You combine that, you're talking about a 97-98% chance they hate Trump. So consequently, they cannot view this question objectively. And so they have to figure out, how do I defend someone whose behavior I find absurd and insane? Well, they must be idiots. They must be incompetent. They must be incapable of thinking. So I'll pursue an incompetence defense. And then particularly when you have a constant framework of characterizing what your clients do as victims, when you have this sort of victim mindset, victim mentality, that's what makes them morally worthy or morally excusable, then you add that layer to it. And I told people early on, this is the kind of defense they're likely to get. Now, to their credit, some federal public defenders and CJA lawyers have actually put up a heck of a fight. Some have been demanding discovery that's been very informative. Some have been fighting bail left and right. So some, I don't want to do with a broad brush. I expected this guy to be the norm. But the fact that he was so public about it, saying, you know, and this is like, I've dealt with this a lot because this is how lawyers handle so-called tax protesters, that they say, oh, you must be an idiot. You must be a nut. You couldn't possibly have a good faith basis for this. And they force them to plead that way, that they're basically an incompetence defense. They're too stupid to form mental cognizance. And we sort of know this in the way that people deal with people who have different political opinions of them. We think our political opinions are because we're smart, because we know the facts, and because we have a good conscience. So if somebody disagrees with us, we either say they've been brainwashed, or they're not cognitively capable, they're just dumb, or they're evil. We go into that progress, when in reality, it likely means they have different lived experiences and different trusted sources of information. But it shows you how bad it is that the legal profession I mean, this is why DC was never going to be a capable venue. You can't get a fair jury out of DC. You're not going to get a fair judiciary out of DC. You can't even get very many fair defense lawyers out of DC. And you combine the three, you're seeing the reflection of it to where people are being told their only defense is this. As evidence develops, that it turns out what many of their clients likely had been telling them continues to get more and more confirmed. They didn't kill anybody. That was a lie. They didn't, you know, have a fire extinguisher and attack anybody. That was a lie. They were invited in some certain cases. They were told it was okay in certain cases. The officers are giving permission in multiple contexts. They're being asked for permission in multiple contexts. Not only are they stepping back, they're waving them in and doing selfies with them. And so all of these truths are being buried and hidden. They've created their own little Warren Commission to come up with a narrative that is about as honest and truthful as the Warren Commission was. And they're doing the same thing in the criminal context. But what this lawyer did, in my view, was malpractice. You don't throw your clients under the bus like this in the court of public opinion.
Well, I know, but maybe I'm more sensitive and more Puritan because I'm a polite Canadian, which I'm not so polite anymore. But it's just, you don't talk like that. You don't swear. You're a lawyer. There's a limit to the swearing. There's a limit to the inflammatory, insulting rhetoric. You don't use the R word, period. And call me a Puritan, call me an apologist, call me like whatever you want. You don't use the R word. As far as I'm concerned, you rarely use the F word unless you absolutely have to, just for comedic effect or just for a punch. But what this guy did was denigrating, even if it was denigrating to his own clients, like you say, okay, my clients are not legally capable of having committed the crime. It was denigrating to millions of other people in the most insulting way possible. It doesn't make the clients look bad. It makes the lawyer look like he's got a loose screw in his head. And I mean, what's terrible is that it's gonna work against everybody. It's gonna work against the clients because everyone's gonna say, look how guilty they are. It's gonna work against the lawyer because they're gonna say, this guy's a total idiot. And it's gonna and it just insults swaths of the general population. It's malpractice to even talk like that and conduct yourself like that publicly when you are a professional, because you are a member of a professional order. You have to weigh your words. That's what you get paid for, is the words you use. And you can't talk like that, even if you think it's funny. He's not a shock jock. He's not Howard Stern. He's a bloody lawyer, and a bloody, not effing lawyer. He's a bloody lawyer, and he should know better, or they should know better.
It shows the disdain they have for clients, and that's the other problem I have with it. You know, if you really have that level of disdain, you shouldn't be the lawyer for the client. But this is the nature of a lot of them. They see themselves as superior to their clients. They don't try to put themselves in their client's shoes. They don't try to understand their client's perspective. They don't try to empathize with their client. They don't try to figure out what the best defense is for their client and understand their client. And by the way, this is common in political cases. Look at the lawyers who defended Saran Saran. Look at the lawyers who defended James Earl Ray and the MLK assassination. Look at the lawyers in a range of that represented Ted Kaczynski. They often refuse their own clients' demands and interests and sacrifice them on the grounds of supporting the institutional narrative, which usually had them labeled crazy, corrupt, but almost always guilty, when in fact that later evidence would show, and evidence that was available at the time of the trials would show, there were major doubts about their guilt for what they were alleged to have done. But for that, you have to watch a hush hush at vivabarneslaw.locals.com.
I heard a noise upstairs that didn't sound good, but I don't hear crying, so I'm going to let it go. I don't know what window lickers means, but it was Dan Harrington or Harrington, Mike Harrington, who posted the short bus always meant mentally whatever. I'm just saying my lived experience with someone doesn't like my experience in life. My wife, you know, they had a short bus at her, a shorter bus just because it had fewer people to fill. So you don't get the long bus to fill the short bus. That was my understanding. Maybe I'm wrong, but, and if I am, whatever, I don't have very much context in which to use short bus ever, nor do I use it. I didn't take it offensively. I just took the rest of what he said to be objectively unjustifiable for any practicing attorney to speak in an interview that you know is going to get circulated around. It's almost like it's a runaway lawyer. I mean,
yes. Yeah. And I think he meant that by the reference to short bus.
Okay. Good enough. So then we had one more, Robert. What was it? Let me see here. Da, da, da. Who's going to get to their notes faster? Chauvin misconduct allegations. So, I mean, I didn't know that there's any new news that we hadn't already covered. What's the new news?
I mean, it's not really new news. It's just being brought up in the context of the other three defendants, which is they're being much more aggressive. The trial got moved, of course, to March of 2022, which means the judge isn't going to move the case because otherwise he could go ahead and start that process. He's using the date as the excuse to say, I don't have to move the trial. But they're saying that the leaking of Chauvin's plea deal prejudiced their clients. They're saying that there was manipulation of the medical examiner's testimony, which had come up before, but they're raising it much more aggressively and asserting, and basically there it's going to be no holds barred. They're going after the prosecutors in the case for everything they've done ethically and professionally. And they're establishing a broader record, and they're making clear that everybody involved in the case is going to pay a potential professional price, at least in the court of public opinion, potentially. By detailing and documenting everything they've done that's illicit. So I think apparently the same team now is being picked for that woman's case, by the way, the taser case. So, I mean, everything's political now. There's going to be St. George Floyd statues somewhere around the world. Maybe we'll have churches dedicated to them soon. And so we'll see. But, you know, it's so political. And I'm not seeing signs from the court that the court's willing to step in. And I think, which is unfortunate. So the defense lawyers are elevating the stakes, which I think is the right move. You can't leave these, you can't just, you know, pretend like people had asked me in the Rittenhouse case, why not say nice things about the prosecutor? I think he's a corrupt, fraudulent prosecutor that I've seen lie repeatedly. I'm not going to say anything other than that about him. An honest prosecutor wouldn't bring this case against Rittenhouse. He's a political hack who's trying to get ahead by railroading an innocent kid because the kid is poor and because he has power. And at least I'm never going to forget it, no matter what. And I'm not going to stay quiet about it. And I think it's good that these lawyers are fighting back on these cases to document highly questionable conduct by the prosecutor. Not that I expect the court to do anything about it, unfortunately.
All right. Now, Mandalore Wise says, if I get a lawyer like this Jan 6 bag, what should I do? What are my options?
You request a replacement. You say that the lawyer is engaging in the magic words with a judge is to say you have an irreconcilable conflict with your lawyer. And that your lawyer is doing things that undermine your ability to present your defense. So you're basically setting up facts that set up a potential habeas petition. That's what gets their eyes open.
Okay, cool. Now, hold on. Let's see what else we got here.
We're both on some of the election cases. I mean, not major updates, but they continue to do the audit in Arizona. They are finding evidence of disparities related to ballot aspects that raise questions about whether the election was conducted in a transparent and accurate manner, that it won't have any impact on the 2020 election for people that have asked that. What will have an impact on is changing the rules moving forward, setting up a precedent, public precedent of you always using these audit procedures and protocols in the future and identifying the source of problems. Georgia court, they brought good litigation there to show there were issues with how the ballots were being counted and kept. The issue they raised was an issue that when I was there in Georgia, I had raised with some other people. And it was a way to track. I didn't publicly talk about it because it wasn't useful. It was if you looked at the ballots in a certain way, compared them to certain things, if discrepancies existed, then here's where you would find them. And they found them. And so now more ballots are being ordered produced out of Fulton County. In New Hampshire, they're finding other discrepancies between the way folded ballots were treated and other ballots were treated in the way the machine, that's actually an AccuVote system up there. So there's, and New Hampshire had some weird things on election night in a few towns. And so, so good audits there. There's some audit procedures moving forward in Wisconsin. The only place that was shut down was Michigan. They're going to appeal that. They use, you know, mootness and the usual excuses. Again, why everybody's scared of audits makes no sense. This should always be the case. We should have transparency in order to have integrity, in order to have confidence. And on our locals page, vivabarneslaw.locals.com, people can go. I put up a link to a speech I did for Hillsdale College in Nashville. It's not on Hillsdale's official site for reasons that will belie the obvious. It's an unlisted, but there on the locals page, you can find a link to it that gets into why I believe election integrity should be a civil right. And there's good reasons for that. But these audits are mostly good news for them, developing good and helpful information to figure out what really happened, what might have gone wrong, how can we fix it, and let's always have audit transparency in elections in the future.
All right. Now, I'm pulling this up because I do not like, if it's ever the case that we say something here that is factually incorrect, correct it immediately. So All I'm saying is, now, Jennifer Signs of Life says, Viva Fry, please set the record straight. The lawyer never said that. It was a rumor, fake news. He gave an interview to the Daily Caller, and it was excellent. Okay, and I'm just going to show you. Vanity Fair is worth what it's worth. But I mean, you know, at some point, let me just say that. Oh, you know what? I can't even show those words. I'll get in big trouble. And I've seen it in multiple sources. So if it turns out that the multiple sources are as inaccurate as other sources, Robert will correct it next week. And
I have no doubt that some lawyers have this exact attitude, because I've dealt with this many, many times. And there's a long history of dealing with it in political cases. So whether this lawyer's statements were accurately reported or not, I guarantee that some January 6th lawyers have his exact views. What the press is doing is they're just finding a pretext to get this information out. Whether they were quoted him accurately in particular or not is just, to me, secondary. I have no doubt there are lawyers who believe this about their clients in this context.
Even if that's true, if this lawyer, it turns out that is not correct what was reported, I will gladly dedicate a vlog to breaking down the more fake news. It is Vanity Fair. Vanity Fair is Vanity Fair, but there were other sources because I checked multiple sources. But if it's not true, I will correct. Sure as sugar, promise. Cleopatra, thank you, David. I was just going to ask about Arizona. What do you both think about Harris being the one to meet with both the PM of South Korea and Japan? How is this even possible? Isn't it an affront to those countries not to be met by a president their equal? Well, I mean, we might talk about that next week, but I know nothing of that to even venture into a discussion. And let me just make sure, Robert, I'm going to go to my notes and make sure that we're not forgetting anything. Is it weirder to have notes on an iPhone screenshot than on paper? Paper seems like more natural, but no, I mean, other than
the... I was just going through the locals questions from Siren. He asked whether the ADA can be used to push back. Look on... Now, this was actually on the locals page, but the best place to look is the template letter that came to me by a bottle in the water. It was inside the bottle and it came out. And it's just an interesting letter, because, of course, I can't give legal advice to random people. So none of this constitutes legal advice, as the ethics boards would like me to remind you. And what you do with it is up to you, because I assert no copyright because I can't, because it came to me magically in a bottle here in Vegas. You might wonder where the ocean was. I might wonder that too, but just showed up. So, but that will answer your question about the use of the ADA as it relates to any attempt to coerce vaccines, because that letter addresses that. It's designed to be a letter anybody can use as information that if they want to cut and paste, it's up to you. But it does have that basic information in it that is about the ADA, emergency use authorization, basically, and it could apply just as equally to an educational institution or a public accommodation, as to what the legal limits are potentially on any compelled vaccine.
All right, I'm going to read this one while you're looking. Orion Free says, Fry, over the past year, you've kept me informed, introduced me to Barnes, Brody, and the Henley shirt. Happy birthday.
Yeah, what's the Henley shirt?
I think he meant Hunley. I think he meant Hunley.
Sir Eric Hunley, yes.
And
unstructured.locals.com.
Robert, we'll talk about one thing after this, but we have over the last year, we started a little earlier, but it's just amazing. Like, I love spending Sunday nights like this. I love the homework you give me. I love the fact, I hope people can hate me and disagree with me. I hope at the very least we're informing people, and I think we are. I never would have thought in a million years that, you know, work and livelihood could meet, and this is what it would feel like, but it's beautiful. And Robert, I thank you from the bottom of my heart for everything we've built here. It's glorious. It really is glorious.
Yeah, no doubt. And we addressed all the other main questions, liked questions on locals, except for the one about Joel Greenberg and Matt Gaetz. Greenberg's plea, the media tried to make a big deal about that. That plea had been in the works for months. And he was the person I identified as the person I thought was trying to set up Matt Gaetz to be an escape hatch for him. But, you know, given what he's pled guilty to, including faking allegations against other political people to gain power and success, I don't see how he's going to be a credible witness at all concerning Matt Gaetz. So unless he has independent evidence, his testimony ain't going to be worth much at all under these circumstances. And I have doubts about the accusations and the motivation for those accusations. Though Matt Gaetz has picked a couple of lawyers, I know them both. I would have gone with a different set of lawyers. But not that there's anything wrong with him. It's just where he's fighting and what he's fighting. Lawyers from New York wasn't the place to go. You're not in New York. You're in Florida. So And it's a different kind of political case than maybe that they are, you know, the best lawyers for. But, you know, not that there's anything wrong with those lawyers. Just that's my only takeaway. But otherwise, I don't think to that local's question that that guy, what the media tried to make of it is nowhere near what they, this was just like Russiagate. Oh, well, you know, Manafort, now it's all going to crumble and Trump will fall. And the same briefly on the New York case, that New York attorney general said she was going to try to put Trump in jail, ran on it to, in order to get elected. That's a major problem given what happened in Missouri. So, you know, the Trump can use the Missouri precedents, but what happened with the McCloskeys, I believe, to use against the New York attorney general now that they're doing things like targeting whether an executive at the Trump organization properly paid for their kids' tuition. I mean, ridiculous things. This is an embarrassment to the New York criminal justice process.
So, and I had this discussion with someone where, you know, they said, I'll wait to see the evidence. And I said, I'll wait to see the evidence. And until such time as I see the evidence and it's compelling, I'm going to smell political corruption. Because when people aspiring for political power announce that they will prosecute, and then they do end up prosecuting it, that the threshold for breaching potential political corruption has already been met. And so they're going to have to convince me that this is not politicized corruption. When they said we're going to do it, we're going to find a crime regardless. Oh, and now we're indicting, and I'm to assume that it's a bona fide indictment. I'll be convinced by compelling evidence when I see it. Until such time as I see it, I'm going to be swayed by the fact that this is already smelling like political corruption and nothing else.
And it was the same week that New York let attempted murderers who were physically assaulting people for racial or religious reasons walk right out of jail with a low level of bail. While in January 6th, you still have people who took, you know, selfies who are still in jail for taking a selfie in an unauthorized manner. So all of these cases smack and stink of politics. And in my view, the New York Attorney General should be forced to recuse herself from any further investigation of the Trump Organization, given she campaigned on putting him under criminal investigation when she couldn't have known he did anything wrong at the time.
It's Kim Gardner, you know, 2.0. Let me bring this on up. First Super Chat ever. Really like this channel and sidebar. Can you think of having Dave Smith on? Comedian? He's on the list. He's one of the ones who's confirmed.
Yeah, he's already committed. He committed last week. So we just have to tie him down to a date. He and Michael Malice are both slippery little fellows. So to tie him down. But this Wednesday will be Amanda Milius, the director, daughter of a famous Hollywood director, herself a director of the movie Plot Against the President, worked at a high level at the State Department for several years. I met her a couple of years ago in D.C., fun, chatty, vivacious personality, very well informed about what was really happening in the inside in D.C., what really happened on the inside of the Trump administration, what derailed certain aspects of the Trump administration. So a lot of inside information, background to Plot Against the President, whether there might be a future film like Plot Against the Election. So a lot of fun conversation up Wednesday for Sidebar.
All right. And on that note, look, we've gone a little over 2 hours, so I think we've covered everything. The Canadian update, go watch my last video on Justin Trudeau having survived his third ethics violation accusation. He was found guilty on two, absolved on the third, and the reasoning is illogical. It's untenable reasoning, but that's my personal opinion. And another one, Charlie LaDuff, for anybody who doesn't read him, just put Charlie LaDuff in your Google alerts so that whenever an article comes up, you're going to get notified. It's glorious. If you have a vendetta or you're a little angry with Gretchen Whitmer, it'll be the cathartic release you need for the day, because every article he writes is what real journalists, and not to say he's in a, it's what journalists should be doing. He is the last, seemingly, of the real journalists who's actually going out and doing legwork to find actual information, to actually do research. And then lazy Canadian just reads his articles and summarizes them in an ADHD fashion so that the rest of the world can watch it and be entertained. So those are the two updates, whatever. Go check out those vlogs. Robert, stick around. We'll say our proper goodbyes. Everyone in the chat, thank you for the birthday wishes. Thank you for all the support. Thank you for making this channel what it has become, these streams, what they've become. You know, 8,000 people watching on a Sunday night. It's glorious. But Robert, lead everyone out of this week into the next week with something positive, something inspiring, and then we'll say our proper goodbyes.
Well, it was really a great week in the sense of America First lawsuits won right out of the gate to enforce our Constitution against racial discrimination and gender prejudice, and the attempts of the Biden administration to coerce state policy against the 10th Amendment's provisions and protections. So on both accords, that was great. And if you want to give a gift to Viva for his birthday, remember, you can get a subscription at Viva Barnes Law. Well, where am I? There I am. VivaBarnesLaw.locals.com, where I will be for the after party in a few minutes and the live chat section. So enjoy as always, everybody, and continue to march on.